All right. Good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is, let's see, what is it? It's still August. It's August 24th. And I think you have a deadline tonight at 11 p.m. to take the first quiz. All right. And we should all be walking around the hallways with the same mantra. What is the same mantra? We should all be saying this. It's three words long, and you find it's a label of a button at the bottom of every quiz, whether it's the Forever quiz or the weekly online quiz. It's a button you gotta click. Save and submit. Yes, save and submit, save and submit. Don't forget that save and submit, because if you don't click that button, then Blackboard will never grade your quiz because it's thinking that you're still taking it, and it will think that for the next 500 years, right? So we wanna give Blackboard a break. Make sure you click save and submit. Otherwise, you'll get a funny error message in your grade book. And that will just slow down the progress. And I don't know what kind of grade you're going to end up with then. I still don't know that much about Blackboard. So save and submit when you're done. Okay. The next week is ready to go, but there's only one section that has the quiz activated, and I haven't figured out a way how to populate some other sections with that quiz. So only 7-1, the CRN that 7-1 has. Blackboard was working before. That's how I got quizzes into all the different CRNs, but I either forgot how to do it or Blackboard's not working. So it might take me a couple days. All the learning modules are there and the interactive exercises are there, just not the quiz for next week. That's due a week from tonight. So you might have to give me a couple days to work on that. Hi there. All right, so last time we just began our look at chemistry, and this might be one of the most fun chapters in the class. I'm not really sure, okay, how everybody thinks about that. But so we're going to finish that up today, chemistry, hopefully. All right, so we started with what an atom is, right, and subatomic particles. What are three subatomic particles?
Protons.
Yeah, protons, neutrons, electrons. Where do you find protons? Inside the nucleus. Where do you find electrons?
Outside,
that's right. Okay, and which of those particles do you want to focus your attention on in terms of being able to identify one element from another element? What determines that? Okay, and that's called the atomic number, and that's the number of protons that are inside the nucleus. And if you look at the periodic table, okay, I can show that today, and I have a cursor here someplace. Here's sort of like a cursor. All right, this is what's in your, I have this in Blackboard. This is what you'll have on the first exam, right? And don't forget, some of these chemical symbols you actually have to know the name of, like Na. What does Na stand for? Sodium. So sometimes it's not very obvious. Other times it is very obvious. Like O stands for oxygen. C for carbon. All right. P for phosphorus. Those are pretty easy. So I want you to know all the important biological chemical symbols and their English word for that. All right. But the atomic number is this first number right above the chemical symbol. So hydrogen has how many protons inside the nucleus?
One.
And helium has? Two, right? So that's how you read the periodic table. Lithium has three, right? Oh, what's Be? You don't have to know that. That might be beryllium, okay? That has four protons. So different elements just have a different number of protons inside the nucleus, or their atomic number is different. Atomic masses we're not so concerned about. That's the big number down over here. But you will have to use the atomic mass of a compound to figure out the molecular weight of a compound. So those numbers are important. Okay, and now electrons are important, not for determining what the element is, but for what kind of purpose are we interested in electrons? Chemical interactions through bonds are determined by electrons, and then even more particular, electrons where? And remember, electrons are in orbitals around the nucleus. Some are inner orbitals. The first orbital only has two. The next outer one has eight, right? The next outer one has eight, right? And you fill the innermost orbitals first. And the outermost orbital has a special name because that's the only one that really interacts with other kinds of atoms. What do we call that last orbital? That's the valence orbital, right? And it's filled with valence electrons, right? So you should be able to figure out how to fill those orbitals up. And over here you see, okay, nice nucleus, and hydrogen has 1. All right, so hydrogen is going to be looking for an additional electron to fill that that orbital up, and sometimes it will form a covalent bond with another hydrogen atom, right? And those two hydrogen atoms will share their two electrons. And what kind of bond is that when electrons are shared? That's a covalent bond. And how strong is a covalent bond compared to all the other bonds that we looked at? That's the strong kind of bond, right? Okay. Then there is an ionic bond. How would you describe an ionic bond? I don't have a slide of it, but you should have a construct in your mind. What happens? It has to do with what? Electrons in the valence shell, valence electrons. Well, what's different about those electrons and how they behave? They don't share. They're either donated and accepted by neighboring atoms, but they don't share. And when that happens, if an atom loses an electron, it becomes a positive ion. Right? And then the atom that accepts that electron gets an additional negative charge. It becomes a negative ion. And remember, opposite charges attract, and then those two atoms are attracted to each other because they have opposite charges, and that's what we call an ionic bond. Okay. I think we were talking about, just as we were leaving last time, the nomenclature on how we name ions. So if there is an ion that looks like this, magnesium actually has exists in a 2+ state. How would you talk about that kind of ion right there? Is it a cation or an anion? It's a cation because of the plus, but furthermore, that doesn't completely describe, right, those two pluses right there. We need to say that it is a divalent cation, right? So here's a divalent, and that valent comes from the last orbital. That's where that terminology comes from. Divalent cation. All right, well, chlorine, for instance, what kind of ion is that? Yeah, it's a monovalent anion, right? Monovalent. So that's how you would completely characterize these ions. Anion. Okay. So that's the proper name nomenclature if you have to get into that kind of detail. All right, then we were also talking about, oh, let me change my cursor right here. Pointer options, arrow options, so I don't have to waggle it around to find it. All right, so atomic number is important to know because that determines the element. All right, we were talking about chemical bonds before. We kind of just got done with this water molecule, and we saw that if hydrogen is bound via covalent bond to a couple of special atoms, most of the electrons are gathered up by, this oxygen atom right here. Or if there's a sulfur, the electrons are going to be gathered around up over here, and they're going to kind of be stripped from this hydrogen atom. So if you walk up upon this water molecule next to the hydrogen atom, you don't see very many electrons. You just see the proton inside the nucleus, so it looks like it has a little positive charge. And because the oxygen is grabbing as many electrons as it can, this end of the water molecule looks a little bit negative. But overall, the water molecule is neutral. So if we add this positive and this little positive with this negative right here, that would completely cancel out. Okay, so there are some atoms that produce hydrogen bond, that can produce this polarity in molecules. And so it's not only oxygen, but it is also phosphorus. When phosphorus binds a hydrogen, it produces a polar covalent bond, or sulfur. That's not on your list right here. You might want to just jot that down. Sulfur will produce a polar covalent bond with hydrogen, as well as nitrogen will produce a polar covalent bond. And because then those molecules have a little bit of a charge, they will be able to dissolve in water very easily if they are polar compounds, right? Because what can you tell me about opposite charges? They will attract. They'll be attracted to water, right? Well, other kinds of compounds that are put together with nonpolar covalent bonds, they will not like to dissolve in water because they don't have any of these little areas of positive or negative charges. All right, so we talked about how these ionic bonds can form. Like, for instance, sodium likes to get rid of that one lone valence electron, and then when it loses that electron, it becomes a positive ion becomes a cation. And since it has a charge, it likes to associate with water because water is a polar liquid, right? What part of the water molecule will sodium like to associate with? It would like, the simplest answer, you would say, well, the negative part of the water, and the negative part of the water molecule is the oxygen atom, right? And so when we put sodium, or even sodium chloride in water, it will completely dissolve because it is hydrophilic. It likes water. It likes to associate with water because of those negative charges. And indeed, there will be different shells of water molecules, right, associating with that sodium cation right here. And we call these things hydration spheres around the water. So sodium as an ion loves to dissolve in water. Same thing for chloride, right, anion. But now, not the oxygen is going to want to associate with the chloride ion. What part of the water molecule? The hydrogens, right? Because this is a polar compound. Okay, so anytime you have a hydrogen covalently bond to an oxygen, it produces a polar covalent bond, or hydrogen bound to sulfur, or hydrogen bound to phosphorus, or hydrogen bound to nitrogen, produce compounds that like to dissolve in water. Okay. And so here are a couple really important concepts, especially in this class. Compounds that are hydrophilic have some area of electrical charge on them. They're either going to be negative or positive, it doesn't matter, but if they do, they can dissolve in water very easily because water is a polar compound. All right. And hydrophilic compounds readily dissolve because they form those hydration spheres. And some molecules that can dissolve in water, besides sodium chloride that we looked at, would be glucose and various amino acids. So you should look forward to seeing some polar covalent bonds in these molecules when we start to look at them. They're going to have oxygen bound to a hydrogen, or nitrogen bound to a hydrogen, or phosphorus to a hydrogen, for instance. While molecules that we say are hydrophobic, right, these are molecules put together with nonpolar covalent bonds. And there's one real important element that typically produces nonpolar covalent bonds with hydrogen, and that is the carbon atom. Remember, carbon was not in that list of producing polar covalent bonds. It was what? Oxygen, sulfur, phosphorus, nitrogen, not carbon. Carbon produces a nonpolar covalent bond, and as such, it forms a hydrophobic molecule that just doesn't want to have anything to do with water. Those hydrocarbons have no electrical charge on them whatsoever. They're completely nonpolar, and so they're really not interested in water. And you kind of knew that all along, right? If you have butter, maybe you're buttering some toast this morning, and just as you grabbed it, it slipped out of your hand, and how does it always fall? Butter side down, and there's your pants right there. You got a nice clean pair of pants on, and you get butter on your pants. Can you just get a paper towel with water on it and clean that butter up off your clothes? No, it's stuck on there because butter is a hydrocarbon, will not dissolve in water because butter is nonpolar and water is polar. These two compounds just will never mix. Okay, so here is another kind of bond. We talked about covalent being the strongest, ionic being a little bit weaker. Here is a third kind of bond that is weaker still, by far a lot weaker. All right, and we call these hydrogen bonds. So here we have a typical water molecule. Remember, the oxygen end is going to be a little bit, what kind of charge? A little bit negative, right? And the proton is going to be a little bit positive, just by the way they share electrons, right? There's a non-equal sharing of electrons in these nonpolar covalent bonds. And here's another neighboring water molecule, right? So the proton on one water molecule will want to associate with the oxygen of a neighboring one, and because their opposite charges attract, this is a very weak bond, and we call that a hydrogen bond. So even in solution, water forms a structure. You could think of water in solution as not really being a liquid, but like a liquid crystal. There's a high degree of structure even in liquid water because of these hydrogen bonds. And because of that, because water molecules actually stick together, even though it's very weak because of these hydrogen bonds, there are still some animals that can even walk right on the surface of water because the water molecules, they're not heavy enough to push the water molecules apart. Have you ever seen an animal walk right on water? Like what kind of animal am I talking about? Like insects and water spiders and things like that? They use this property of the stickiness of water due to these hydrogen bonds to actually walk right on the surface of water. And that's an important process in our bodies that we're going to have to deal with, especially when we get to the respiratory system. Okay, and that the process of water molecules kind of sticking together right on the surface of the water is what we call surface tension. It takes a certain amount of energy, a certain amount of tension to push these water molecules apart. Okay, so on this slide, I want you to realize that you should know now three kinds of bonds and their relative strength. Like the weakest is hydrogen bond, the intermediate is ionic, and the strongest is covalent. Okay, and the other interesting thing, make sure you know that there's a difference between polar and nonpolar covalent bonds, right, with that hydrogen. All right, so before we move on to acids and bases and the pH scale, anybody have any questions on those different kinds of bonds? In every case, you're going to be interested in electrons found where? What kind of electrons for bonds? In the valence shell, right, in the valence shell. Okay. All right, acids and bases. And this makes sense only if we talk about a water solution, not maybe a solution with gasoline, right, but water. Okay, so here are a couple definitions. An acid is any kind of compound that when we put in water will release protons or these hydrogen ions in a solution. All right, so here is a hydrogen ion, right, it's a cation. It goes by another name. If you take a hydrogen atom, like we have right over here on our periodic table, which has a proton in the nucleus and an electron in an orbital, and if we take that electron away, what are you left with? Yeah, you're left with a positive charge just due to that proton that's inside the nucleus. So people use those terms interchangeably. Proton or hydrogen ion are exactly the same thing. That's like saying dorsal and what? Posterior. Right? People just interchange these terms all the time. So another way of saying what an acid is that it's a proton donor. Right? It donates protons to solution. Or you could say what? It's a hydrogen ion donor, either one. But most people say proton because it's quicker to say proton rather than hydrogen ion. All right, a base, on the other hand, okay, is something that secretes hydroxide ions into solution. All right, and that lowers the proton levels of a solution, right? So it's a proton acceptor. It accepts hydrogen ions from solutions. And here are some common kinds of acids and bases. Hydrochloric acid is a very strong acid. When we put HCl in water, it dissociates completely into chloride minus and what? H plus. How would you talk about H plus? Two different words you could use. Proton or hydrogen ion, right? Okay. And here are some bases over here like sodium hydroxide. That's a very strong base. When we put NaOH in water, it completely dissociates into Na plus NOH minus, right? That's a hydroxide anion. All right. Furthermore, if we take hydrochloric acid and put it in together with sodium hydroxide, guess what happens? This proton over here can bind with this hydroxide ion right here and form what kind of compound? Water. Yeah, it's fairly violent. We don't ever really want to do that in lab. But that can form water, so hydrochloric acid and sodium hydroxide will what? Neutralize each other. If we put an acid together with a base, they will neutralize each other. These have basically about the same kind of strength. So here are some important acids in our body. Phosphoric acid is important. Carbonic acid is important. Okay, so I think these, I would kind of like for you to at least know phosphoric acid and carbonic acid. Well, I'm going to talk about those later on in the class. These aren't going to be on your first test, but if I mention them later on in the class, I want you to remember that I at least talked about them. Okay. Yeah, I just remembered something. I think I forgot to pass the sign-in sheet around one time, and I have just a couple blank pieces of paper. Put sign-in sheet on there for me. I didn't even have time to label it. And put the date, which is the 24th. And even Bio 241. Pass it around and sign it, please. Okay, you want to go back? Like here? Yeah? Okay. Now, don't forget, you can find all these slides in Blackboard. And as a matter of fact, this table is in your book. It's table 2.2. Okay? So I don't want to dally too much on that particular slide. But if you want me to show it to you after class, I will. Okay. So pH is a concept that we need to deal with a little bit. You might even have to work a couple problems in your homework on pH. But what the heck is pH? It's a measure of something. It's a measure of acidity of a solution, right? And so it's just a symbol that tells us what the hydrogen ion concentration in a solution is, right? The pH scale runs from 0 to 14, never any negative numbers. So if you calculate a pH and you end up with a negative number, guess what? You punched the wrong button on your calculator somehow or another, okay? So here is the equation. This should all just be one dividing line right here. That's really not a minus sign after the equation. Right, pH is equal to the log of the inverse of the hydrogen ion concentration in molarity. And so if you know the molarity of the hydrogen ion concentration, then you just take the inverse of it, then press log on your calculator. That will tell you the pH. Right, so invert the concentration, take the log of it, that's the pH, and that number will go from 0 to 14. And there's a number right smack in the middle of 0 to 14, and that is pH 7, right? And that means that there is an equal number of hydrogen ions and hydroxide anions. And that means if there's an equal number in solution, then that's a neutral solution. It is neither acidic nor basic. All right? Acids have a pH number less than 7. So from 0 to almost 7, those are all acid. As the number gets smaller and smaller and smaller, it means the solution is more acidic. So this conceptually you have to deal with. It's a little strange. Okay, and I'll tell you why it's a little strange in just a little bit. All right, bases have a pH greater than 7, so it's from 7 to 14, and there cannot be a pH that's greater than 14, right? 14 is the maximum. So if you have a pH of 7.1 is that acidic, basic, or neutral? 7.1, a little basic, right? A little basic. If it was 6.9, that would be a little acidic. Okay. All right, so here is what we're really looking at. If we look at the molar concentration of hydrogen ions in solution, and molar just means that there's one mole of compounds in a liter of water, right, to get that particular concentration. Now, what the heck does that, what does that mean, one mole? There's a certain number of particles that are in that water, that 1 liter of water, and it's what we call an Avogadro's number of particles, and it's a huge number. And I think I had to memorize that number like 30 years ago. What is it, 6.234 or something, times 10 to the 23rd, a huge number. If we take that number of molecules and stick it in a liter of water, okay, that makes a molar solution, okay. And if we make a molar solution of hydrogen ions, it's a pH of 0, right? We plug it into that equation, right? Put 1, what's the inverse of 1? It's 1. Okay, 1 divided by 1 is 1, right? Take the log of that, and that's 0. The log of 1 is 0. All right, so that's the pH right there. And then we got 0.1, and so the pH is 1. So you can see that the exponent on the power of 10 right here determines what the pH is, right? So if you have a concentration of 10 to the minus 8, the pH is going to be pH 8. Okay, and the molar concentration for hydroxide ions just goes in the opposite direction. So as the concentration of protons increases, guess what happens to the concentration of OH? It goes down, right? So they go in opposite directions. Okay. Yeah. Uh-huh. The hydrogen ion concentration? Okay. Punch that into your calculator and use the exponent. I think it's times 10 to the minus 4th, okay? And then take the inverse of it. You might have a 1 over x function on your calculator. If you don't, say 1 and then divide and then type in the concentration, okay? Then hit equal. That will take the inverse of the concentration and then take the log of it, and then that will be the pH, okay? But you know what? Your lab instructors would really like to help you with all that kind of stuff. All right, so sometimes I don't have enough time in lecture, but that was so easy for me to describe. A lot of times I have to draw something out. But your lab instructors just love to do things like that, okay? I'm happy to help you too during office hours, okay? So as a matter of fact, your lab instructors would be happy to go over any of those pre-lecture reading questions or any of the online questions or labeling the exam figures. And as a matter of fact, I would never leave lab early. I would stay right in lab until the last minute, work with your lab instructor on those questions, or form a little study group, for instance, okay, and quiz each other on how to do these kinds of things. That's really important. So after lab, if you have an hour left over, I wouldn't run off to the cafeteria and just drink coffee, right? Really use that time to work with each other, network a little bit, and work some of those questions. Okay. Okay, I'm going to skip this slide for a second. I want to talk about blood pH. Here's the normal range for blood pH. It's given 7.35 to 7.45. And why is that important? Well, link this up to another concept that we were talking about the very first day in class or the very first lab. What's normal? Homeostasis. What does that mean? Okay. Yeah, you're okay as long as your physiologic parameters like pH, okay, vary a little bit. It can vary from 7.35 to 7.45. It means you're in a healthy state, a non-disease state. You don't have to be exactly, 7.40 pH to be healthy. Homeostasis means that all these things dance around each other, but nothing changes drastically. So this is what we call the normal range. This is not the set point. This is just the normal range. Now, if you deviate from this range right here, then you're in a disease state, and we start to question whether homeostasis is really operating, and then it's a job of medicine to bring you back into homeostasis. All right, so if you have a pH less than 7.35, we call that acidosis. If it's greater than 7.45, we call that an alkalosis, and there can be different kinds of acidoses or alkalosis produced in your body. We'll probably talk about some of these, okay? And as a matter of fact, I want to tell you, this looks like what, a broad range or a narrow range? That looks pretty narrow, okay? And as a matter of fact, let me just impress upon you, I'm going to kind of make this up. I don't have any data, so this is not a theory, all right? So this is just my best guess. But just say you're absolutely normal. You're operating at 7.40 blood pH. And is something running around up there? I heard a little ree-dee-dee-dee. Oh, he's running across the floor. No. Okay, so just say your blood pH is 7.4. And then all of a sudden, you ate a bunch of acid, like you drank a big Coke, like 20 ounces of Coke Slurpee from 7-Eleven or something. Coca-Cola has a pH of about 1 or 2, so it's very acidic. Right, you would think that that would decrease your pH because you're eating all of that acid. If your blood pH dropped from 7.4, say down to 7.2 or 7.1 in just a matter of a minute, that would be fatal. That's how important that number is. Okay. Now, if your blood pH changes over a period of a month or a couple of weeks, you can compensate. Okay, but not instantaneously. That's how important that number is, because it determines the chemical reaction rate of most chemical reactions in your body. All right, so this is a very important number. So you might be now ready to give up drinking Coca-Cola, okay? But let's go back to the previous slide. That's not necessarily a big concern for you because you have buffers in your body. You have various chemical compounds, and we're going to look at a couple buffer systems. As a matter of fact, all proteins in your body are buffers. What the heck is a buffer? And I'm going to say it a little bit differently than what's in your textbook, okay? But buffers are molecules that can slow changes in pH by either combining with or releasing protons into solution. That's what your book says. I want to say it in a little bit different way. And it's going to be on the key for your pre-lecture reading assignment, so you don't necessarily have to write it down. But the definition I like is that a buffer is a chemical compound that will prevent changes in pH, right, the hydrogen ion concentration, when either an acid or a base is added to solution. So if we add an acid to a solution, what happens to the pH if there's a buffer in there? Doesn't change. If we add a base to a solution with a buffer in it, it doesn't change because it has a buffer. Right? It doesn't mean that it's going to take the pH to 7 to neutrality. It will keep the pH, whatever it's set at, right, but just prevent changes in pH whenever we add an acid or a base to solution. Okay, here is an important buffer system, the bicarbonate buffer system that we find in blood. All right, so here we got H2O. What's that?
Water.
Water. And then we got CO2. What's that? That's carbon dioxide. Our body produces that all the time just by the normal respiratory processes of our cells. And that's going to form carbonic acid. Okay, and we looked at carbonic acid before. Carbonic acid, if it's in water, is going to dissociate and produce hydrogen ions. All right, and bicarbonate anion right here. Well, here we have carbon dioxide producing hydrogen ions. What the heck is that? What is a hydrogen ion? It's building hydrogen ion concentration in solution. What's that? It means it's increasing the acidity of this particular solution. All right, now why is this a buffer? Okay, so if we have bicarbonate also in solution, there is a real fancy chemical concept. Okay, notice these arrows right here. What direction are they pointing in? To the right or to the left? They're bidirectional. So this reaction can slide to the right, it can slide to the left, and which way that it slides depends on the concentrations of these compounds right here. So if we add, so we have bicarbonate in our body all the time, because what is our body making? CO2, it's making CO2. Now if we drink a Coca-Cola and we dump a bunch of these hydrogen ions in solution, it's going to combine with bicarbonate and it's going to force the reaction to the left. And when hydrogen ions then bind bicarbonate, what happens to the pH? Of the, if these are what you're drinking and they combine with carbon dioxide to produce water and CO2, right, what happens to, does the concentration of hydrogen ions increase? The answer is it doesn't, because it combines with bicarbonate. So bicarbonate is acting as a buffer in our body. Okay, it's eating up these protons. It's keeping them from going into solution, but your body is then producing water and carbon dioxide. And what do you do with carbon dioxide? You breathe it out of your body. Okay, so that's sort of an interesting respiratory buffer system. All right, so this buffers pH, because the reaction can go in either direction depending on the concentration of hydrogen ions. And if the concentration of hydrogen ions decreases because you eat a lot of base for whatever reason, right, then the base is going to combine with these protons. The proton concentration is going to decrease. That means the pH is going to increase. But since there's bicarbonate right here, this reaction is going to go to the right, and it's going to rebuild the proper concentration of hydrogen ions in solution, maintaining the body's pH. So that's a very important buffer system, the bicarbonate buffer system, due to this compound right here. And you can see it interacts with other processes inside your body. Okay, we looked at that slide already. All right, so I want to draw something on the board. Hopefully you guys can see the board really, really fast. One last thing. This pH, until you're familiar with it, gets to be a little bit tricky. Let's draw three beakers right here. Is that marker? I don't want to mess with the projector too much. So here we have beakers. And for pH, What kind of solvent is in these beakers in order for it to make sense for pH? Could there be oil in here or what? Water. It's got to be water, right? Okay. So here we have a beaker, and it's got H2O, all right, and it's got a bunch of these. What are these? Hydroxide, you know, and a couple of those. All right, so my question would be, what's the nature of this solution right here? Is it neutral, or is it basic, or is it acidic? Okay, and you're right. It's basic because why? Look at all of these hydroxides. There's more hydroxides than hydrogen ions. If there's more of these, it's got to be basic. All right, what about this water beaker here? Is it acidic or basic? Yeah? Oh, speak up. Yeah, I got another one. Okay. So now this one right here, what does this look like? Is this acidic or basic?
Neutral,
because the number of hydrogen ions is equal to the hydroxide. Right? So you could tell me exactly what pH this is. 7, right? So pH 7. How's that? Is that better? Okay, so here's basic. You can't tell me the pH of this one because I didn't tell you the concentration of hydrogen ion right here. But if I did, you could calculate it. But you know what? It's basic. Now, what about this one here? Not very much in terms of hydroxide, so this is an acidic solution, right? Acidic. All right, now here's the tricky thing about pH. As the number of hydrogen ions increase in solution, does it become more acidic or less acidic? It becomes more acidic, right? As we add protons to solution, it becomes more acidic. Now, what about the pH number? Which way does that go? As the solution becomes more acidic, okay, does the pH number go up or does it go down? Yeah, it's inversely related because of that equation that we use to calculate pH. So as the solution becomes more acidic, as the hydrogen ions increase, the pH number decreases. We call that inversely related to each other. All right, you're going to have to think about that one. That's a little bit of a mind teaser sometimes for students just learning something about pH. Okay? And I think I had a slide that maybe shows that, right? So here's a hydrogen ion concentration increasing, right? 10 to the minus 14th is a really small number, right? And here's one. Look at the pH number. It gets smaller and smaller and smaller as the concentration increases, just due to that equation that we used. All right, so don't get fooled about that. How are we doing? Any questions on that so far? Okay. Okay, organic molecules. Let's talk about some organic molecules. There are basically four classes of important biochemicals or organic molecules in our body, and we're going to list them for you really soon. But I want to define what an organic molecule is. It's a molecule that has a carbon atom. That's definitely got to be the case. And it's got to have a hydrogen atom. And it's got to, and these two atoms have to be bound to each other by a covalent bond. And then I could ask you a really fast question. Is that a polar covalent bond or a nonpolar covalent bond? Okay. What produces polar covalent bonds with hydrogen? Oxygen? Nitrogen, phosphorus, sulfur. What about carbon? Nope. It produces a nonpolar covalent bond. Okay, and here's some stuff that we'll deal with probably. Carbon has four electrons in the outer shell, so it wants to share those four electrons with four other electrons someplace to fill up the shell to make sure that it has eight electrons completely. Okay. So organic molecules, since they form nonpolar covalent bonds with hydrogen, do they like to dissolve in water? No, they are hydrophobic compounds. It has no area of positive charge or negative charge. It wants to have nothing to do with water. Okay. So here is a nice typical kind of organic compound. We see carbon, and here we have a hydrogen. This little line right here represents the sharing of two electrons. That's one covalent bond, and there's another covalent bond right here. And all of these bonds are nonpolar, so this particular hydrocarbon hexane won't dissolve in water. It's a nice organic compound. And this hydrocarbon chain like this can form a backbone, can form other kinds of molecules, because in this position right here, or any of these different positions, we can substitute other kinds of atoms, maybe an oxygen, for instance, or a nitrogen, or a phosphorus. All right, so this hydrocarbon chain works as a nice platform for building various kinds of organic compounds. And if we were to switch this hydrogen with a different kind of compound, we would call that a functional group. If we change the structure of this compound right here by putting maybe a phosphorus there, all right, we change the structure, what's that going to do to how this molecule functions? Drastically going to change it. All right, so that's why we're interested in chemistry in this particular class. Furthermore, this hydrocarbon chain sometimes likes to bend back on itself and form a ring. All right, so this just represents a long hydrocarbon chain. And the same with this one right here. And we don't usually always draw in all of the carbons and all the hydrogen bonds right here because it's just too time consuming. So this is just, what, a cyclohexane. Here's a hexane molecule that has formed a ring. And depending on whether there's single bonds or double bonds between certain carbon atoms, we can form even other kinds of compounds, for instance, like benzene. These are not so important in our body, but this is a good basic place to start for looking at hydrocarbons that do not like to dissolve in water because they have all these, what, nonpolar covalent bonds. Okay, but can form a very important backbone. All right, so what are some functional groups that can be used? Do you notice the hydrocarbon backbone right here? Okay. At this carbon position, we got a double bond to an oxygen. All right, we call that a carbonyl group. And that makes this compound a little bit more soluble in water, a little bit. All right. Here is an OH group. We call that hydroxyl. And then on this carbon, here is a SH. That's a sulfhydryl group. All right. And now, what did we say about oxygen bound to hydrogen? What kind of covalent bond is that? That's a polar. That's a polar covalent bond. So this guy right here does like to dissolve in water. So if we put OHs on all of these carbons, then we go from a hydrocarbon that doesn't like to dissolve in water to one that really does like to dissolve in water if there are OHs all over the place on it. The same thing for this sulfhydryl group. This is a nice polar covalent bond that allows this compound to dissolve in water. And what about nitrogen? Yes, that produces polar covalent bonds with hydrogen as well. Right, so that produces different kind of functionality on this molecule. So that's why we call all of these things functional groups. This group right here, the COOH or carboxyl group, makes this an acid. Okay, and so fatty acids will have this kind of structure to it. And then here we have a phosphate group. This also makes this end of the water molecule dissolve in water very nicely too, because that, look at all these OH groups, right? That produces polar covalent bonds. All right, so this is an organic acid, this is an organic acid, this is actually a base right here. And then this would be an alcohol. All right, so I do want you to know the names of these functional groups, and next time we're going to start looking at some of these names with a flash quiz. All right, I'm not prepared to show you that today, but I think you'll learn the names of these functional groups pretty quickly in class once we start to use them in lecture. All right, so the first important kind of biological molecule, organic molecule in our body, first class, is what we call carbohydrates. Carbohydrates. And this is what the structure of a carbohydrate looks like. You see, it kind of looks like benzene, except it has different functional groups on it. On the end, right, we got this aldehyde group here. In the middle, we have hydroxyl groups. All right, and because of that, right, benzene won't dissolve in water, but because it has all these hydroxyl groups, glucose does what? It has all those polar covalent bonds. It dissolves right into water, no problem. Okay, so this is a hydrophilic kind of compound. And if we were to look at each position right here, we have a carbon atom. And besides the carbon, what else do we have just at this level in the molecule? We have an OH and an H. How many H's is that? Two. How many O's is that? What's H2O? Water. And that's how they named these particular compounds, because somebody analyzed this compound and found for every carbon atom, they found what? H2O. And so they called this class of compounds carbon hydrates as a result of that. Right? So carbohydrates should sort of make sense. Another name for a carbohydrate would be a sugar molecule. These are very sweet tasting. Or you could say a saccharide. Sugar, saccharide, or carbohydrate pretty much are all the same thing. This one right here has how many carbons in it? It's got six. Glucose has six. Here's another one called galactose. It has six carbons, but sometimes these OH groups are on the opposite side of the molecule. We call those isomers, and they behave a little bit differently. Here is another six-carbon sugar. We call this fructose. It forms a little bit of a different ring structure. But nonetheless, these are all what we call monosaccharides. Monosaccharides. Simple sugars or monosaccharides. These are all six-carbon monosaccharides. Some have five carbons on them. And you might be familiar with a five-carbon sugar that's important for making DNA and RNA. That's called ribose. Ribose is a five-carbon sugar, but again, it's soluble in water because it has all those H groups on it. Okay. So these are simple sugars. Now, your body can take a simple sugar and add two of them together. And when it adds two monosaccharides together, we call it a disaccharide. All right? And here are a couple important kinds of disaccharides, like sucrose, that's table sugar. It has one glucose and one fructose. Oh, I want to go back to the previous slide. All right, these are some exam figures. I don't want you to know that this is glucose and how to differentiate it from galactose or fructose, but whenever you see a long hydrocarbon chain with OHs on it like that, I want you to recognize that as a sugar molecule and not a protein or an amino acid or a lipid, right? Or if you see this cyclic thing like that, I want you to know that that is a monosaccharide. So that's the level that I want you to understand these sugar molecules at. All right. Lactose, or a sugar molecule we find in milk, has one glucose and one galactose molecule joined together. Maltose has two glucoses put together. So there can be different kinds of disaccharides depending on which monosaccharides that are actually joined together. Okay. Sometimes, actually it happens a lot, we put more than just one monosaccharide together. Many, many, many. Sometimes thousands. In that particular case, right, it's not a disaccharide, it's what we call a polysaccharide. Right, so we put a bunch of monosaccharides together, we get a polysaccharide. So a good kind of question would be, what's the basic building block of a polysaccharide? Yeah, a specific example would be glucose, but a general term would be monosaccharide. So I would say, what's the building block of a polysaccharide? You would say monosaccharide, and I'd say, give me a specific example. You could say glucose, galactose, fructose would be some specific examples, right? All right, so some important polysaccharides would be starch. Starch, and also glycogen. Starch is the kind of storage molecule for glucose that plants make. All right, and the only molecule we find in there is glucose. So the monosaccharide that makes starch is glucose. Starch is a polysaccharide made up of glucose molecules. Glycogen is very similar, but only animals make glycogen. Glycogen is stored in our liver and some muscle cells, and it's a storage form of glucose. So if we put 1,000 glucose molecules together in our body, we call that glycogen. And glycogen is very similar to starch. The branching pattern is just a little bit different. These are both polymers of thousands of monosaccharides of glucose put together. They're very, very similar. So when I say polymer, what the heck does a polymer mean to you? It's a big, long molecule with a repeating unit over and over and over again, right? So you should think of a polymer as made up of building blocks, right? So the building block of a polysaccharide would be a monosaccharide, just all put together the same way. So starch and glycogen are important energy storage molecules, and it's just a way of storing a lot of sugar in somebody's body or cells in a way that doesn't interfere with their water balance. And we're going to talk about osmotic properties of our body later on in the class. Okay. All right. So how, indeed, does your body put two monosaccharides together to get a disaccharide or extend the concept to make a polysaccharide? All right, notice that sugars have these H's and OH's bound to them at these various carbon positions, and it forms this nice cyclic ring. And sometimes glucose will bump into another glucose molecule so that these two OH groups come in close proximity to each other. And what is highlighted right here in yellow? H, 2, and O. And when that happens, right, there can be a chemical bond formed between these two monosaccharides, and then that produces a water molecule. So what do you call it when we take water out of something? Do we hydrate it or dehydrate it? We dehydrate it. So we call this a dehydration synthesis reaction. Dehydration synthesis reaction, or sometimes a condensation reaction. So a disaccharide can be made from two monosaccharides with a dehydration synthesis reaction. Okay, and water comes out. So here we see maltose, and then here we see glucose and fructose making sucrose or table sugar. And again, what kind of chemical reaction is that? That's a dehydration synthesis reaction because you see water coming out of it as well, right? So your body uses this reaction over and over and over again to what? Build more complex molecules. It's a very nice, easy, elegant reaction to produce in your body, dehydration synthesis, okay, for the production of polymers or macromolecules. But not only that, all right, I didn't redraw this arrow right here, but this arrow really should be a double-ended arrow. It could go back the other way. Maybe you want to break that complex polysaccharide or disaccharide down into its building blocks. What would you end up with? Monosaccharides, right? Okay, so the name of the reaction that produces monosaccharides from polysaccharides or more complex saccharides is what we call a hydrolysis reaction. If then the dehydration reaction produces water, guess what's used up in a hydrolysis reaction? When we break this bond right here, water is used up. It's actually split, right? One monosaccharide gets an H and the other monosaccharide gets the OH, and now we've split those two molecules apart. We call that a hydrolysis reaction. All right, and that can be used for maltose, can be used for sucrose, could be used for lactose as well. Any disaccharide would be a hydrolysis reaction. All right, so here is something interesting about water. I'll mention this a number of different times. So not only is water the solvent that our body is dissolved in, all the chemical reactions are dissolved in water, right? So you need to dissolve enzymes in it to make a solution, right? But water is also a participant in many chemical reactions. So not only is it the solvent, it's a metabolite that's being used by various chemical reactions to make your body work. So it's handy. It's really handy. Not only are you dissolved in it, but it also becomes an important structural feature of your body. All right, so those are carbohydrates. Let's talk about lipids. Now, lipids, do lipids dissolve in water or no? They're mostly just hydrocarbons. Okay? We're going to see that they can be modified a little bit, right? But basically, they're insoluble in polar solvents such as water because they are hydrophobic. They have no negative or positive charges on them, so they don't want to have anything to do with water. They consist primarily of hydrocarbon chains. What is that? Carbon with a hydrogen on, repeated over and over and over, like benzene, for instance. All right. You've probably heard of a triglyceride before. Maybe you've had a blood test and they want to measure triglycerides in your body, make sure they're within what? Normal range, right? Make sure you're in correct homeostasis for lipid metabolism. And here is a triglyceride. The building blocks of a triglyceride is one glycerol molecule, and here we see a hydrocarbon chain, and on each of these carbons there's an OH group. That's a glycerol molecule. You'll become familiar with that when we get into respiration as well. Now, there are three carbons right here. So we can add three fatty acids, one at each of these positions, right? This OH, this hydroxyl group, is a functional group which gives some functionality to this particular molecule. Instead of being just a hydrogen here, right, this OH allows a special kind of reaction to take place. Here is a fatty acid. It's too long to draw all of it out, so we have a little dashed line saying that this, it could have as many as maybe 20 carbon atoms, maybe as few as 8, right? That's a variable. And then if we look at this end right here, here's a nice important functional group that's been added to this hydrocarbon chain, which changes the structure and function of this thing. This becomes a fatty acid because this carboxyl group is an acidic group. And so here we have an OH, and over here we have an OH, and guess what can happen here? If these molecules bump into each other in just the right way, guess what can come bonking right out of here? A water molecule. What do we call that when water comes out, when this covalent bond is, that's a dehydration synthesis reaction. Not just one to form a triglyceride, but this happens three times over with three different fatty acids to form this triglyceride, which is what? A glycerol that has bound to it three different fatty acids. And this is called a fatty acid because this carboxyl group right here, what, is an acidic functional group, right? That changed the reactivity of this hydrocarbon chain. So your body didn't have to invent a new fancy kind of chemical reaction to make this. You could almost think of it as a polymer, but it's just a more complex molecule going from four smaller molecules to one bigger molecule. That's a synthesis reaction. And when water comes out, that's a condensation or a dehydration synthesis reaction, just like what we saw for carbohydrates. Don't have to learn anything new. It's just the same thing. And guess what? You can go back the other way. What kind of reaction would you use to go back the other way? The hydrolysis reaction, right? So in order to break a triglyceride down completely to glycerol and three fatty acid, you need three water molecules to do that and an enzyme to control that chemical reaction so that it takes place. All right, here are a couple. So again, you should see that theme. Dehydration synthesis, when we put small molecules together. Hydrolysis, when we break large molecules apart. All right, here are a couple examples of fatty acids. Notice how long this hydrocarbon chain is. This is palmitic acid. You don't have to know the name of this one, but you should be aware. Here's a nice carboxyl group right here. right? That is an acidic group, so that's why we call this a fatty acid. This is typically what fat looks like with this carboxyl group. We combine those terms together, fatty acid. And notice, between every carbon, there's only a single bond. Every carbon atom has two hydrogens bound to it. So we say that is a saturated fatty acid. Have you ever heard of that before? A saturated versus what kind of fatty acid? Unsaturated fatty acid. And what an unsaturated fatty acid is that this hydrogen is taken off, okay, one here and maybe one over here, and now you have to have a double bond between these carbons. And so here we have an unsaturated fatty acid, and notice that in a couple positions we have a double covalent bond. All right, and that changes the properties, it changes the melting point, it changes a lot of physical properties and how your body has to handle these particular fats or fatty acids. Okay, so saturated versus unsaturated fatty acid. And notice that linoleic acid has even more carbons than palmitic acid on it. Okay. All right, now here is a very interesting molecule. It's almost one of the basic molecules of life. All right, so when you think of hydrocarbons, you think in your mind, is a hydrophilic or a hydrophobic, a hydrocarbon? Hydrophilic or phobic? Phobic, because it has no polar covalent bonds, right? They're just non-polar covalent bonds from carbon to hydrogen. All right, and so when we have this molecule here, let's analyze this molecule. This could be on the test because it's so important. All right, here is a fatty acid, but it's bound to something. What was that molecule with three carbons that had an OH on it, on each carbon position? That was glycerol. So here is a basic glycerol molecule, and fatty acids bound to it. So this part of the molecule right here, a long hydrocarbon chain, is this end of the molecule hydrophobic or hydrophilic? Does it like water or not like water? The hydrocarbon chains don't like water, don't want to have anything to do with water. Okay. Now look at this carbon right here, the other terminal end of glycerol. It's been bound to a phosphate group, okay, and another group that has nitrogen on it right here, plus these oxygen atoms, there was a hydrogen right here. So what kinds of chemicals produce polarity? We said what? Sulfur, phosphorus, nitrogen, oxygen. Look at this end of the molecule. It's loaded with those molecules that produce polarity. So this end of the molecule, is it hydrophobic or hydrophilic? It's hydrophilic. So here is a molecule that likes to dissolve in lipid, part of it, but the other part likes to be in water. It likes to be in water. So it's a very fascinating kind of compound because it has this phosphate. This is a phosphatidyl group. You don't have to know that. But since it has this is what you do have to know about it. Since it has this phosphate group right here, and it has these lipid components over here, we call it a phospholipid. It has both natures. It has both hydrophobic and hydrophilic natures. And if we were to kind of ignore the chemical structure and just draw it out, we would say that one end right here that has the phosphate group and all these positive and negative charges, this is the polar end of the molecule. It's hydrophilic. And then this is the non-polar end of the molecule that has these long hydrocarbon chains, two legs sticking down. So this right here is a nice phospholipid. Okay, that has the hydrophilic head group, because it kind of looks like a head, and the hydrophobic tails right there. All right, so let me find my marker. And is this a good time? Yeah, this is a pretty good time to talk about this. Let me erase the beakers. Now, why is that such an important molecule, biochemical? Yeah, maybe from anatomy you can remember that we see it in membranes. All right, now why is that? Yeah, make sure everybody signs a sign-in sheet as it's being passed around, or it's going to be up over here. I'll grab it in a little bit. All right, so I'm going to draw something here on the board. Ah, what's that? And then there's like a little cork right here. What do we have right there? That's a nice salad dressing bottle that you have, right, in your refrigerator. And that's a really kind of interesting laboratory, because here is the top of the fluid, right? It's almost a brand new bottle. But if you have it in your refrigerator for a long period of time and look at it, it has a lot of structure associated with it, right? Because there's a line right here, right? A meniscus. There's stuff up here that you can't find down over here. What do you find up over here? Okay, this is the oil part, and then down over here is the water part. All right. So what dissolves in the water? I mean, what dissolves in the oil? Nonpolar kinds of compounds, various kinds of oils and lipids dissolve over here, and then what's in the water down here? All the tasty stuff like salts and spices and stuff, because they're polar compounds, right, dissolve over here. So when you want to put some salad dressing on your salad, you don't just pour the bottle, because what do you get? You just get oil. So what do? You got to shake it up and mix everything together, right? And then when you're done, you put the bottle that's all mixed up together back in the refrigerator, and then you go back the next day and look at the bottle, and what do you see? It's all separated. Now, was there somebody in your refrigerator separating these two compartments out, or did it just happen automatically by magic? It was by magic, right? But now you know it's not really magic. It's because some molecules are hydrophilic and some are hydrophobic, and they don't want to have anything to do with each other. These have charges on them. These have no charges on them, okay? All right, so that's just something that happens automatically. Not really magic, but it almost seems like magic. All right, now let's take this guy right here. What is that molecule? That's a phospholipid. And the interesting thing about this is that it has two domains. What is this domain right here? It has the phosphate nitrogen right on it. This is the hydrophilic, right? Hydrophilic, likes water. Here's the long hydrocarbon chains, two of them sticking down from the glycerol molecule. So this big region right here is the hydrophobic region. All right. Now let's take this molecule and stick it in the bottle right here. Where are you going to find that molecule in the morning? Is it going to be up here in the oil? Is it going to be down here in the water? It's really cool. It's going to wander around in this bottle, and it's going to exactly line up how? The head group here and the lipid groups, just like that. It's going to be right smack in the middle of the bottle. Did you have to do anything special? No. Automatically, it's going to find its way right there just by the nature of the molecule. Now, instead of just one molecule, let's put in a couple thousand. What's going to happen to them? They're all going to be where? No. Right here. All right, and then if you really kind of look at this and use your imagination a little bit, what do we have right here? You have something that looks a lot like a membrane. Right, because a membrane actually has two of these layers, but now you've made a membrane in the salad dressing bottle, and did it cost you a lot of effort to do that? No. Membranes have a tendency to build themselves given the right environment. Membranes are self-assembling, which is, and what is a membrane for? That surrounds what? The basic structural and functional unit of life. The membrane just builds itself automatically by the nature of this particular molecule. That's why phospholipids are so fascinating, okay? Because they have a tendency, what? To build structures associated with life, naturally. All right, so, as a matter of fact, if we didn't have oil right here, but just these phospholipid molecules in water, we see the slide behind me, all right? These hydrocarbon tails don't want to have anything to do with water, so they'll all poke into the very center of this sphere that forms, and then the phosphate groups are going to associate with water. Water is going to form a hydration sphere around them. This structure now doesn't really necessarily look like a membrane. Goodness gracious, what does it look like? It kind of looks like a cell. I mean, it looks like a pocket of stuff separate from the water environment with this little simple membrane around it, and we call that a micelle. Okay, a real membrane that makes our cells just has two layers, has a phospholipid bilayer, has two layers, because the inside of the cell is not lipid, right? It's actually what? It's actually water. So you're going to have other head groups poking down over here. All right, so this molecule right here, we say it can act as a surfactant. All right, could act like a detergent, because you could actually use a phospholipid to get that butter out of your pants if you wanted to, because part of it will dissolve in the butter, and the other part will dissolve in water, and will help make those two dissolve into each other. All right, so that's a phospholipid. I do want you to be able to recognize this structure or something that looks like this as a phospholipid, right, that's got that phosphate group. So don't be surprised on a test. We'll look at some of these things. Or even if I turn it upside down or whatever, you know this is what? Phospholipid. And phospholipid belongs to what class of compounds? Carbohydrate? No, it's a lipid. It's a lipid. We classify it as a lipid. All right, here's another kind of lipid. We call these steroids. It has a number of different ring structures. Okay, steroids are lipids, so do they like to dissolve in water? Absolutely not. They're hydrocarbons. They're hydrophobic. Here is what cholesterol looks like. So anytime you see these four cyclic rings right here, and you can see it kind of looks like a staircase. Here's a step, another step, and another step right here. I want you to say that that is for sure a lipid, but a steroid of some kind. This is cholesterol. And is cholesterol good or bad? If you have too much, yeah, it's both. Perfect. That's the deal. That's how we have to look at things in this class. It depends, and you've got to develop an understanding. Cholesterol in high concentrations is bad because it produces cardiovascular disease, but it's the precursor molecule, okay, for various hormones like cortisol and testosterone and estrogen, right? And nobody would want to give away any of these hormones right here, right, by sucking all the cholesterol out of your body. So it's important in the right concentration. It also helps stabilize membranes. So it's an important component of membranes as well because it will dissolve. Where would this like to dissolve? Right in here, right? It's going to dissolve in this part of a membrane, in the lipid area of a membrane, because this is the nonpolar or hydrophobic region. All right, so if you see a molecule that kind of looks like this, you're just going to say steroid. I don't want you to tell me exactly which steroid it is, but you would say some kind of steroid. Okay, this right here is a long hydrocarbon chain with a carboxyl group on it, right? And if just pretend this bend isn't here. If it was just one big long chain, what would we call that with a carboxyl group on the end? That's what we would call a fatty acid. But if we put a bend right here, we get something that's called a prostaglandin. It's the same kind of molecule. These are used as signaling molecules as well as hormones in your body. And their basic nature is what? Prostaglandins are basically lipids as well. Okay? Okay. So prostaglandins are fatty acids that have this little bend in them. They've been modified. They're produced by most tissues, and we're still learning a lot about the kinds of prostaglandins and what their function is. Sometimes it produces inflammation, sometimes not. That's just kind of a complicated topic. So I want you to say, when you see this structure, prostaglandin. When you see this structure, I want you to say steroid. And when you see this structure, phospholipid, or this kind of thing, phospholipid, and when you see that, fatty acid, and when you see this, you'd say, one, two, three, that's a triglyceride. Three fatty acids on a glycerol molecule. Okay. How would you make a triglyceride from glycerol and three fatty acids? Dehydration synthesis reaction, right? Dehydration synthesis reaction. Oh, we're not going to get done today. Okay, proteins. We've got to talk about proteins and nucleic acid jet. Okay. So the basic building block of a protein will be amino acids. All right. And if you had time to study and learn your functional groups right now, I think you might be familiar with what an acidic group looks like. That's what a carboxyl group right here. And what did we say an amino group was? It had a nitrogen. So here's a hydrocarbon. It's got a nitrogen or an amino group and a carboxyl group, so we call that what? Amino acid. So here's what an amino acid looks like. This carbon right here, sometimes we call it an alpha carbon. It's got both the amino group and carboxyl group, but it also has this little side chain on it that is represented with an R. That just means that it has a high degree of variability at that particular position in an amino acid. And when you change the structure of this functional group right here, guess what you're changing? You're changing the function of that particular amino acid, how it likes to interact with other kinds of things inside of a cell. So let's look at what some of these different functional groups look like. Okay, here is valine, and you don't have to know the names of these, but there are about 20 important kinds of amino acids. Now, this group right here, do you see any positive or negative charges? Okay, I don't see any. So is this hydrophilic or hydrophobic group? It's a hydrophobic group, really doesn't want to have anything to do with water. And the same for tyrosine, this group right here. Okay, oh look, there's a little bit of an OH right here. Maybe partial solubility. Okay, but basically these are nonpolar amino acids. right? But other substitutions, we can have nitrogen and nitrogen and nitrogen, which what? Makes us very polar. The same thing for this sulfhydryl group in cysteine, makes it a very polar kind of molecule. And this carboxyl group right here in aspartic acid makes it very polar but acidic, and this group makes it basic. So proteins can have a huge range of activity based on what kind of substitutions are put in this carbon right here that changes this functional group. And I believe we're done for today. But I'll leave you with one question. We said that amino acids are the basic building block of a protein. Protein is a polymer of amino acids. How would you put amino acids together to make a protein? What reaction would you use? I haven't told you, but use what you know about carbohydrates and lipids joining smaller biomolecules together to make a bigger one. What reaction have we used? Dehydration synthesis. And guess what we use right here? Dehydration synthesis reaction once again. Okay.